Do you have a favourite parable? Well, how about we start with a bit of Bible trivia. How many parables does Jesus tell? Across the Gospels, how many parables does he tell? I'll give you a hint. It's a biblical number. It's 40. 40 parables. Depending on exactly which ones you say are parables, there are some that are very much like parables, and some people include them and some people don't. But generally, most scholars would say there are 40 parables. Some are told in just one gospel, some are told in two gospels, some are told in all three of the synoptic gospels. So how many in each? Well, there's 23 in the Gospel of Matthew, there are 9 in the Gospel of Mark, and there are 28 in the Gospel of Luke. There are 7 that are told across Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And of course, in the Gospel of John, there are none. Well, there are things that are kind of like parables. If you count, say, for example, Jesus talking about the gate of the sheepfold, maybe that's like a parable or a metaphor. But generally, scholars say no. The 40 parables are only in the 3 synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Some of them are unique to each of the gospels. In Matthew, there are 10 parables that only he tells. In Mark, there's just 1 parable that he tells that's unique to him. But in the Gospel of Luke, really you could say it's the gospel of the parable, because there are 15 of the most famous parables that we have that are unique to Luke. Parables like the Good Samaritan, parables like the ones we had last week, the parable of the lost coin and the lost son. Matthew also tells us the parable of the lost sheep. The one that we have today, the parable of the dishonest manager or the dishonest steward, is again one of those parables that are unique to the Gospel of Luke. But unlike some of the others, I suspect there are very few people who claim the parable of the dishonest manager as one of their favorite parables. The parable is confusing at best. It's one that much ink has been expended over the years in trying to make sense of it. Some people have attempted to explain it in very symbolic ways. Some people have tried to work out where the parable begins and ends. All of these questions have challenged scholars over the centuries. The parable begins with this rich man who has a steward, a manager, someone who's taking care of his estate. The Greek word is oikonomos. It's someone who's looking after the household in the most general sense. We don't really have anything kind of equivalent in contemporary societies. So it's hard to translate this particular idea. Manager or steward is perhaps the closest that we can come. One of the problems when we hear parables is we generally hear them in the context of a gospel proclaimed in church, which is a very formal setting. When Jesus first told these stories, it was in a very intimate setting, just him and this group of the disciples gathered around. We hear in verse 14 that the Pharisees are also there listening in, so they're hearing as well. But it's hard to imagine that anyone who first heard this parable would not have burst out laughing, because it's a very funny, bizarre, quirky kind of parable. It twists and turns, and we're meant to understand this is a little bit on the edgy and weird side. Jesus tells us about this steward who is overextending himself. He's being wasteful with his master's resources. Now, it's interesting, that is part of the problem of the lost son, the prodigal son, that we had in last Sunday's gospel, that he was also wasteful with his father's resources. It's exactly the same word, the same idea. This steward is being wasteful. He's overextending himself. He's using the corporate Amex and going out on these extravagant trips and wasting the master's resources. That's the charge. And when the master comes to the steward and says, "This is what I have heard, and so I will dismiss you," the steward doesn't say, no, you've got it all wrong. That's a misunderstanding. No, what I was doing was all authorized and all valid. No. The master, when he accuses the steward simply says, okay, he cops it. And perhaps that's the first thing that we need to note. There is at least some honor. He doesn't try and weasel his way out of a situation that he can't get out of. But he's left with this dilemma. What is he to do? In a first century Galilee, in first century Judea, where it's very poor situation and circumstances, many people would starve to death. Many people wouldn't have the resources necessary to support themselves in the face of such poverty brought about by the persecution of the Roman Empire. And so, as the guy says, what are his choices? He's not strong enough to go digging. Not a great choice anyway. Nor is he humble enough to beg. He's too proud. He's too upright to go begging. So what is he to do? And this second thing is what really sets apart this steward. He then stumbles across this idea. Ah, I know. I will call each of my master's debtors one by one and begin to deal with them. Now, to understand what's happening at this moment, and this is kind of key to a valid understanding of this parable, we need to remember some of the background to this story. We need to remember what the law of Moses allowed and what it prohibited, what the different laws or the mitzvot required. One of the things that is very strong in the law of Moses, and we find it in a whole range of places in the early books and the first five books of the Bible, that it prohibits taking interest on a loan, particularly with the whole broader idea of never to exploit the poor. The poor, the widow, the orphan, the stranger, the foreigner, all of those people must be cared for in a very particular and special way. You cannot exploit them. And so prohibiting taking interest was one of the ways that the law protected the most vulnerable and the poor. And hence our psalm response today, this whole idea that the Lord loves the poor and looks after the poor. And so here we have this situation, which really gives us an insight into one of the ways that the people got around this law. So if you originally were owed 50 measures of oil, what you would do is on the original bond of agreement, you wouldn't write the 50, you would write a higher amount to cover up the taking of the interest or the profit that you would make on the deal. And so there would be a certain proportion that would be the profit owed to the master. There would also be a certain proportion owed to the steward, that he would also take some of that profit. So when he called the first debtor and asked him, "How much do you owe?" And he says, 100 measures of olive oil. A measure would have been about 30 liters. So it's about 3,000 liters of oil that was owed. He said, no, here, take the bond and write 50, 1,500 liters of oil. So the next one, he said, well, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 bushels of wheat. A bushel would have been the amount of wheat that you would get from 1 acre of land. And so it's about the equivalent of harvesting 40 hectares or 100 acres of land. He says, here, no, sit down and write 80. Now, the profit in both cases would be about the same amount, about 250 denarii. A denarii is the equivalent of a day's wages. So all up, we're talking at about 20 months' wages that he has saved from these two transactions alone. And these two transactions are simply there as examples of all of the different transactions that he makes over the next day or two until it's found out and becomes public that he's no longer the steward for the master and he's able to no longer act in the situation. So what is he doing? He's quite brilliant. And that's why the master in verse 8 praises him, because he is saying to these people, this is the profit that is due to the master. This is the profit that is due to me. But I'm going to forego both, knowing that the master can't complain. The master can't take it to the courts. The master can't take it public without first exposing himself to this illegal, from the point of view of the Mosaic law, practice of taking interest, of making a profit out of these dealings. So the master has nothing that he can do without acknowledging that he has been acting dishonestly himself. The steward is also foregoing his own profit in order to win favor with these potential friends so that he can win favor with them and perhaps find a place of welcome in their own houses. The steward is being quite brilliant, and that is what the master in verse 8 recognizes and understands. And we had to understand that the master there is not Jesus. It's not Jesus who's praising this man for his dishonesty, but it's the master in the parable, the master in the story, who's praising him for being so astute, for being so shrewd. And that is what lies at the heart of how we had to understand this parable and why this parable is so powerful. When St. Luke came to write his gospel, when he prepared his material, he had this story and he wanted to include this story, but he also wanted to make better sense of it so that we would not misunderstand what it was about. And hence he added these extra verses that have information about how do we deal with money and such questions and matters. What is at the heart of how to live as a disciple of Jesus? What are we to do? How are we to respond? And part of it lies in this decision-making ability that this steward exhibits, that he's able, in the face of a crisis, in the face of this terrible dilemma, he's able to come through and make a decision. He's able to say, this is what I will do. we also are faced with crises and moments of decision in our own lives. Right across the scriptures, right across the Gospels and the Old Testament and the New Testament, there are these opportunities and these occasions when we are also forced to make a decision for God, for the kingdom, or for ourselves. What are we to do? How will we respond? How will we make this decision in our own lives? Will we choose for God and for the kingdom? Or will we, like this steward, who makes a decision, sure, but it's a decision about his own life and about feathering his own nest above and beyond what is required of the Gospels. Jesus is calling us to indeed make this decision, but to do it in terms of giving our money away to the poor, to make it in terms of choosing justice, choosing what is true, choosing what is good, what is beautiful, what is honorable, what is noble. That is our choice. That is our call. When we come to a crisis moment in our life, when we are forced to make this decision, what will we choose? The only way the spiritual masters tell us to ensure that we make the right decision at that moment is to begin today to make the right decision now. Let's begin today to choose the way of God. Let's begin today to choose the way of the kingdom so that we, at the final moment, when we reach that ultimate crisis in our life, we'll be ready, easily, and simply choose the kingdom of God. Amen.